This is Jeanette Paris, February 8, 2013, and the talk is entitled Love in the City, Heartbreak Clinic. This recording was made on DVD. There were a few slides, not many. They're available in the library of the Seattle Jung Society.
Jeanette Paris is a psychologist, a therapist, professor, author of many books, including Wisdom of the Psyche, Depth Psychology After Neuroscience. Her books have been translated into French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, German, and Russian. Dr. Paris is core faculty at Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara and a research consultant for the Depth Psychology with somatic studies emphasis. Her latest book, Heartbreak, Recovery from Lost Love and Mourning, serves as the basis for tonight's lecture and tomorrow's workshop. Please join me in welcoming tonight Dr. Jeanette Paris.
Thank you. Thank you. I would like to start with myth, the major myth we are in today. In this culture, which is neuroscience. It's the most crucial. We need to understand where we are culturally before we can understand what a heartbreak is. So let me just bring you through that demonstration. And as you can see here, okay. What do you think those who wrote that magazine in 2010 concluded with the question they ask, are we entering a new era of practice? What do you think that conclusion was? Yes. And as a demonstration, you can see that today, if you don't have the prefix attached of neuro, your patient won't trust you. So you have to be neuro everything. I will need a bit of help to read the screen, so maybe I should start from the first row. And if you don't feel like reading aloud to the group, you just go like this and we switch to the next person. So who would read the first screen, please?
Everything. Neuropsychoanalysis, neuropsychology, neurocounseling, neuroethology, social neuroscience, social psychology, molecular psychiatry, biological psychiatry, medical humanities, developmental cognitive neuroscience, developmental psychobiology, psychosomatic science, psychological medicine, physiological psychology, emotional brain training.
And Pacifica started its own program in somatic. So it tells you how, and this is just the short list. So let's go back 20 years to understand what the cultural myth was then. Remember this. This was, at the time, the dominant myth was not we are our brain, which it is today, was we are our genes. Because we had just, as a culture, we were all very impressed and with good reasons with the decoding of the human genome. So if you see it here, it was called the total human sequence is the grail of human genetics. So that's one of the biggest metaphor you can think of to say, this is really, really big. This is the, so it's a story that will repeat itself with neuroscience. It's coming too. But let's see first how this one, developed as a myth. So it begins with very inflated metaphors. The discovery of the human genome is the Holy Grail, it's the sacred text, it's the Book of Life, it's Jacob's ladder, it's the Code of Codes. So you see, this is almost religious. Then it becomes textual: Book of Man, Dictionary, Encyclopedia, Instruction Book, Parts Manual, Recipe Book. You can see how it deflates. Then the computer metaphors. It starts with the Code of Codes, which is kind of, you know, woo, that's big. Human software, digital archive, compact disc. And some deflating metaphors: garbage dump, pigsty, hodgepodge. And this had a reason for that. It's when, you know, scientists discovered that many of our genes had to do with how we fought viruses 100,000 years ago, viruses and bacteria that don't even exist. So they were saying, you know, there's a lot of our genetic codes that's just not that relevant. And that's also when some critique began to say, you know, evolution, and why do you make such a big deal of the fact that we have 99% of our genes in common with great apes? Because we also have 50% of our genes in common with the banana. So there's a book now that just came out. It's called Raymond Thalès, a philosopher, who calls that. His book is Aping Mankind, and it's a critique of, you know, how neuroscientists and those who worked on the genetic code were insisting a bit too much on our similarity with the great apes. And he is a philosopher, and he is saying this is very dangerous, because when you become, if you forget what humans are capable of, that is specific to us, you undo the whole system of human culture. Mostly, you know, the justice system, everything that humans are the only one to. So his subtitle is his title is Aping Mankind, Neuromania, and Darwinitis. And it has to do with, you know, the inflated claims of geneticists and today of neuroscientists. And it's not because what they have discovered was not of great importance. It is, and it's wonderful, and it's beautiful. But there are things about the humans that are not only physical. We are not our genetic codes, and we are not only our brains. Of course, the whole machine has to be in working order for you to be able to learn language, but once you have the working equipment in the head, then there are other things. So the critique for neuroscience is beginning, and my sense is that the same thing is going to happen to neuroscience, and that book by Raymond Thalès, and I'll write the reference. Well, I don't have a blackboard. Thalès is the equivalent of the critique that we had 20 years ago of decoding the human genome. So let's just see how it manifested in the culture. So at the time, 20 years ago, you could pay, at the time it was $4,000, to have your genetic code mapped. Today it's free. You just have to send, it costs $200, but you send a swab with your saliva to the website of the National Geographic, and they're doing a research, you know, how to very fascinating research to see migration patterns. So if you sign a paper that gives them permission to use your information, it costs $200. But at the time of these mapping services, it was much more expensive. What's interesting is their publicity. This is me. This is my code. Decode me. So I am my genes. That's the cultural message. I am my genes. If I know what's in my genetic code, I know all I need to know about myself. And they use one of the highest, Know Thyself was what was written at the entrance of Apollo's temple in Greece. That was kind of Apollo's sense of the wisdom, to know thyself is to live the good life. So that was their publicity, using, one of the biggest philosophical kind of formula to point at the necessity to become wise, know thyself to become wise, but then it's about the genetic code. And that was one of the most popular, many companies use the same, know thyself injunction. You could even have art with your genetic code on your bed. And the next one is the legal agreement that you had to sign before you would have your mapping of your genetic code. And when I read it, I thought, this is something every psychotherapist could put in big letters, in their office, and it reads like this.
Consent and legal agreement, 23rdandme.com. You may learn information about yourself that you do not anticipate. This information may evoke strong emotions and has the potential to alter your life.
Thank you. And it ended with this. So, mostly because, your humanities came in. And one of the reasons is also that, when you're a scientist, to get grants, you have to hire those who are professional grant writers, and they always inflate. It's not always the scientists who do the research. But like we'll see in neuroscience, you ask for a grant because you say that you think you've discovered the pleasure spot in the brain. Turns out it's what part of the brain lights up when the rat eats chocolate. So it's a bit, but they will claim that they're discovering the bit to get grants. So it's an important point because it's not always the inflation of the scientists, it's the way they get funded. And so they're always discovering, the wisdom spot. And but when you look at the research, it's with rats or mice. And so philosophers come in and say, wait a minute here, happiness in humans is much more complex than that, and the whole brain is activated, and not only with chocolate. So what happened is that the critique of this inflation, because on the one hand it's wonderful and it's crucial and it's very important, the work on decoding the human genome, because lots of, crucial medication may come from that. The cure of Alzheimer and autism and schizophrenia. These research are very beautiful and very important. But at the same time, coming from the field of genetics and neuroscience, they are beginning to become conscious of their own limitation, of what is it that is invisible. There is an aspect, about wisdom and the psyche. You cannot put love and heartbrokenness and bereavement under the microscope. And it's not enough to just, you know, see what lights up or turn off or on with human misery. There is a meaning to it. So they are themselves coming with their own critique.
In the past century, there was an unfortunate division between the subject matter of neuropsychology and the lived reality of the mind. This once prompted the neurologist Oliver Sacks to write that neuropsychology is admirable, but it excludes the psyche.
Okay, so that's a neuroscientist. By the way, just a little question of vocabulary. Neuroscientists never use the word soul and rarely use the word psyche. Their way of understanding what's visible under an MRI and or slices of the brain, dead brain under the microscope, is to say the brain. So that's the biological visible aspect on which, you know, you can look at what hormones, how much electricity, where in the brain. And the part that's invisible, they usually call it the mind. But for those of us who are trained in depth psychology, mind, brain, anima, and psyche would all be equivalent. So just, you know that. They don't use soul. Never. But when they say the mind, it includes psyche, soul, anima, everything that is not visible biologically. Here's another one, conclusion by a neuroscientist.
We are not prisoners of our genes or our environment. Our own free will may be the strongest force directing the development of our brains, therefore of our lives.
So this is really big, because free will is the main philosophical conversation that humans have been having, you know, since the beginning of philosophy. It's like the big topic, you know, what is the good life and how much are we free to take our own decisions. So it's as if neuroscientists are saying there's a place where we have to start a conversation with philosophy. It's as if, you know, they themselves see what is in their territory and what is the territory of the humanities. Now, here's another one by Eric Kandel. So, Eric Kandel, any of you saw the extraordinary series with Charlie Rose on the brain? So it's excellent, really. It's a series of interviews, Charlie Rose, and it's, you can still see it on PBS. And it's there, he interviewed with Eric Kandel, and Eric Kandel is the Nobel Prize winner for neuroscience. So I guess we can trust what he has to say.
Stated simply, the regulation of dream expression by social factors makes all bodily functions, including all functions of the brain, susceptible to social influences. These social influences will be biologically incorporated in the altered expressions of specific genes in specific nerve cells of specific regions of the brain. These socially influenced alterations are transmitted culturally. They are not incorporated in the sperm and egg, and therefore are not transmitted genetically.
So this really is the biggest endorsement for an approach that is depth psychological. What they are saying more and more is that the brain reacts to culture. The culture formats the brain. And by this, they mean everything you read, the conferences you go to, the friends that you have, the kind of music you listen to, the style and architecture of your house, the type of hobby that you have, the conversations, the kind of pleasures that you choose for yourself, all of that has an impact on the brain. So the brain and the culture are connected, and it's as if, you know, the experience you're having in the world creates, through proteins, it changes the genes. So this is quite fascinating. For one, it takes away a lot of the importance that was given to cognitive behavioral approaches. You know, they are just a form of training of the limbic brain, but the culture includes everything that we traditionally call the humanities. So the milieu you live in, the culture, the sophistication, or the lack of sophistication. For example, if you live in a, you know, place where there are no libraries, no concert, you have no friends, you don't get new ideas, you don't try anything new, you don't learn anything new, your brain ages much more rapidly. So doing Sudokus and crossword puzzle is not enough. Not enough. It won't keep your brain active. You need to be engaged with deep, strong ideas and to find meaning in what you do. And isolation is not good for, you know, you can be alone in the country and reading books. That's a way of being connected and listening to music. But a lack of richness in the milieu is definitely very detrimental for the brain. And now the philosopher that I just recommended had this to say about neuroscience.
Absurd and unwise. The point is this. The more you think about the idea that human life can be parceled out into discrete functions that are allocated to their own bits on the brain, the more absurd it seems. Neuroscientists who think they have found the circuits in the brain corresponding to wisdom seem to lack that very quality, as a result of which they are oblivious even to what the more critical minds in their own discipline are saying.
So from there, I would like to make clear how the fact that neuroscience is saying culture formats the brain, and of course you have to have a good functioning brain to receive the gifts of culture, but if culture formats the brain, it means that there is a new kind of possible collaboration between those of us who have been trained in depth psychology, which, according to Jung and Freud and Hillman, belongs to the humanities, not to science. You know, psychology is divided in two. You have scientific psychology, and you have depth psychology, that who belongs to the humanities, not to the science. It's not the medical model of experimental or clinical psychology, but it's something else that belongs to the humanities. So what is it that we share in common, you know, depth psychology and all of the what does it mean when we say the humanities? One of the definitions is the places, the humanities are the places where we create values collectively. What do we value? What is it that we don't value? Another classical definition is the humanities are the place where we ask ourselves, what does it mean to be human? Or, what is the good life? Or, how and when can we aim for freedom? How much freedom do we have? So here are the three pillars where depth psychology is part of the humanities, the values we share with humanists. That's my own little summary.
The idea of we are free to make choices
find new meanings and renew the myths, symbols, metaphors we live by. Philosophers call it free will. Jung calls it individuation. Neuroscientists call it the brain-environment equation. The point being that we are not only defined by our genes or brain patterns. There is a positive value in becoming more conscious of our values, ideologies, projections, complexes, shadow, repressed memories.
So, just a comment on this one. Not everybody wants to be more conscious. So if you're here tonight and have read Jung and are part of the Jung Society, it's very important to know that, that there are many people who don't want to be conscious. And we have to respect that. And usually in very traditional societies, when the values still work in that community, you know, when Jung wrote about the God complex and the natural religiosity of the psyche, it's because he was seeing the effect of the faith, the traditional faith, was broken in his family, broken in his village, broken in his culture. So he was seeing how, you know, when the traditional church gives you everything you need, there's the brain will not go through a transformation. If it works, don't fix it. Basically, that's what the brain works, how it works. If it's traditional values are still in place, really, usually people are not so motivated to change. I remember that was put very clearly to me by a patient who was very, very bright and intelligent and loving the process of individuation, and a student at Pacifica. And her sister was somebody who was very materialistically oriented. And my student was always trying to convince her to become more conscious of her complexes and this and this and that. And she said at one point, my sister put the brakes on her Mercedes, stopped by the road, and said, "Look, my condo, my bank account, my Mercedes, this is who I am. You get it? That's it. I'm not interested in anything else. The more I get, the happier I am. This is me." And, you know, the student understood that she had to respect that. Her sister did not want to be pushed into becoming more conscious of many things that the other sister wanted to become conscious of. So it's not everybody who is interested by more consciousness, but if you are a humanist, you do place a value on becoming more conscious, projecting less, knowing who you are, know thyself. This is a recurrent value in all philosophers. And the last one.
When the myths, the symbols, the religions, the political system we live by are crushing to both individuals and communities, they need to be put on the couch, debunked, deconstructed, seen through, dethroned.
So when a myth has become a personal myth or a cultural myth has become destructive, it's time to deconstruct it. That was what the whole deconstruction period meant. In the past 50 years, the two main myths that were debunked and deconstructed are racism, that it was totally absurd to make distinctions based on the color of the skin. In fact, our blood types are a much more profound difference between humans, but I don't know any culture who differentiates, you know, the good and the bad in terms of their blood types. It seems absurd to us, but same is true with color of skin. What counts are the values and the culture we live by, not so much, it's very superficial. And so that racism was deconstructed, And the other big one is sexism. You know, if you're old enough, you probably remember that it was believed that women could not be pilots, plane could not fly planes, because they would have their period and the plane would crash. Any of you remember that? You do? Okay, so that was, the myth then, that women were more emotional and were not good at math, which is true. Why all of our generation are not good at math. We were told that the brain of a woman wasn't good. Not so today. Girls in schools that don't make difference and give them examples, to learn mathematics, you have to do things instead of, a car going at 70 miles an hour, and you have, examples of with pies and cakes. And when a myth is crushing, it has to be debunked, declared a lie, which is one of the meaning, the most ancient meaning of the word myth. It's both a foundational story and a lie. It can be an inspiring story, or it can be something that is crushing. So now I want to move into the physiological aspect of the heartbroken brain. Because this, looking at the brain, what happens in the brain is a necessary aspect of a heartbreak. We do have a brain that goes in a physiological state that is extremely dangerous, equivalent to torture. I was told by a neuroscientist that a heartbreak is similar physiologically as being submitted to torture. So the same physiological problem, it's extremely dangerous. It's not recognized enough. We don't pay enough attention, especially heartbreaks with adolescent, because it's present in every criminal murderous behavior. There's always 100% time a heartbreak behind it. But schools don't pay attention to that. Parents say, "Oh, you'll forget it. You'll forget that the day of your marriage," which usually what we tell them, like it's nothing. You're young. You're 15. You'll get over it. But many suicidal adolescents never get over it because they commit suicide or they kill. So it's very important. It's also important in terms of adult health because, you get 2 weeks off maybe and then you have to go back to work. So the body falls into a deep depression. So we need to really rationally understand what's going on in the brain. And I'm going to use two approaches. One is the triune theory of the brain, the three aspects, the reptilian, the limbic, and then the specifically human dimension of the brain. Not so much as a theory, because it's not very useful nowadays. They're all doing much fancier things with localization. And also maybe a bit about the new theory about the two sides of the brain. How many of you have read or been interested by Ian McGilchrist, his new book that just came out? It's called The Master and His Emissary. I-A-N, McGilchrist. And just remember, you'll find it on Amazon, just know the title, The Master and His Emissary. So his point basically is that we have the two sides of the brains, but that's not a new theory. 30 years ago, there was Julian Jaynes. So, do you remember his theory? So, Julian Jaynes' theory gave rise to lots of language and ways to formulate our thinking, you know, like women were supposed to be right brain and men were left brain, and if you were an intuitive, you were a right brain. If we were good at math, you were a left brain. So it was like as if the distinction between those two brains was something you could be on one side or the other. And this author, Ian McGilchrist, who is both a clinician, he is a psychiatrist, a philosopher, and a neuroscientist. So he is looking at this and he's saying, you know, the brain always works from both sides. You cannot be on one side. You cannot be only intuitive and or only rational and logic. The brain is always looking at every situation from both sides. So we cannot separate. But his point is these two sides have very contradictory vision of the world. And his point is that our culture has given priority to the scientific and logic way of looking at things. And we think this aspect is the master, but it's very, very similar to, you know, the two points of view of the conscious and the unconscious, and how often the unconscious has a position, a point of view on things that is in opposition to the conscious mind. So he shows how there's a battle between those two sides. They're always present all the time. And you cannot decide you're going to lean on one side or the other. And we have to live with that. This is how we're made. There's no choosing. You know, you cannot decide that you're going to honor only the feminine principle and leave the rest. You know, even astrologers resist their fate. So this is also true when we're going to look at the different aspect of the brain with this, you know, think of it as a drama. It's a story. It's a movie. A heartbreak is a story with three characters. And we need to be aware that childhood experiences remain present in the fold of the brain. That's something that neuroscience has demonstrated. So it's kind of almost like an approval of the depth psychological approach that takes into account the unconscious dimension of the psyche. And as you all know, the main difference between a depth psychological approach and a behavioral cognitive approach is that behavioral cognitive approach never takes into account the unconscious dimension. I'm not saying it's wrong, it's useful. You know, it's like a training. In fact, it is a conditioning. I remember when I was a young student in psychology, we worked in hospital, and we would use conditioning to convince patients to make their bed and they would get a reward, or to learn to do things. And I don't want to be vulgar, but the most pressing was to learn to teach them to wipe their own ass. Otherwise, the medical assistant had to do that, and behavioral cognitive approach were the only one that worked. We didn't go asking, you know, what was their unconscious love of caca. We just trained them to do it, to clean themselves, you know. So for a year or so, as a student, you use all these approaches, and they're very, very useful to this day. You know, it's very much like teaching. if you get it right, you get a reward, and you learn different ways to express yourself. So it's behavioral cognitive approaches are great for all sorts of things. How to stop smoking, addiction. Some aspect of it is good with addiction. But they never take into account the unconscious. So neuroscience seems to have confirmed that preverbal memories stay in the brain. You know, preverbal meaning things that you've learned before language, which are limbic memories. And it's the same thing as, you know, if you've ever seen a horse teaching a colt, a mare teaching the colt not to walk on a snake, that's a limbic imprint. It's like the horse doing that teaches the colt not to do that. Or, you know, a young child that we scare so that he never touches the gas. So it's like, don't. So there's an emotion there that's very sudden and very strong that teaches something. So even with a one-year-old child, it will work. And sometimes with abuse or parents who are afraid of everything. I had a patient whose mother thought that having sand between your toes was horrible. So she lives in Santa Barbara, has never been to the beach. You see, that's a limbic imprint. You know, like very young, before she had the capacity to make it into a story, she saw the mother going with the sand between her toes, just like the mare who teaches the little colt that not to step on a venomous snake. So neuroscience has confirmed that there are preverbal memories. So that also confirms that as therapists, we do have patients that have trauma that are preverbal, and they cannot tell you the story because it happened before they had the words to create a narrative. So they call that preverbal or prior to the narrative capacity, which is a word that neuroscientists also use. Now, the second thing I found really fascinating is that although preverbal memories cannot be dislodged, and it's true of the fear of the snake, you know, once that reflex is activated, you cannot undo it. It's like you cannot erase it. The only way is to add a new layer of connections that makes the prior response less intense. So a new layer of connection, neuronal connection, can be added. For example, when you see a snake, somebody can teach you to breathe so you don't faint on it. So that also means that, you know, moral injunction to forgive, forget does not work, but adding new experiences does. And now the last aspect that neuroscience help us understand is that the symbolic reconfiguration, the repertoire of metaphors, that's at the highest level of, you know, only humans use metaphors and symbols, impacts our neuronal connections. So this is the main thing I have to do with you tonight, and especially tomorrow, look at that level where changing the symbolic milieu changes the reactions, changes even the brain. And we'll see more of that. This is the main thing that fascinates me, is that if you change the myth, if you change the symbol, you change the story, it not only changes your perception, you are adding new connections physically biologically in the brain. Maybe you've seen research of that was done in England that, you know, to pass your exam to become a taxi driver in England, you have to know an incredible amount of streets and no GPS allowed. You have to know everything. So somebody decided to study the brain of a student wanting to become a taxi driver. And what happens is, as they learn to orient themselves in the city, the brain changes, and the part of the brain that has to do with spatial orientation grows. So you see, the experience, the day-to-day experience, changes the way the brain allocates the neurons and the configuration of the whole brain. So it's the same with changing the story, changing the metaphor, changing the symbol. It changes something in the brain. It's connected in that way. Now let's go back to the most primitive reaction in a heartbreak. And the first character on stage is going to be the character I call the crocodile. That's, of course, the reptilian brain and all the basic reflexes, what Jung used to call the instinctual level. Remember when he wrote that archetypes exist at an instinctual level, but also at the other end, at the spiritual level, it goes from the instinctual to the spiritual level, and he says it's all, you know, a kind of continuum. So the reptilian brains control breathing, swallowing, heartbeat, startle reflex, and the visual tracking system. In fact, it's faster than the perception through the eyes. So you have that kind of reaction, you know, when if you read interviews of men who've killed out of what used to be called a crime of passion. In the past, it was understood that no man could control their reflex, and routinely, until the 20th century, judges would absolve men who killed their wives and her lover when they found them in bed. So they thought it was uncontrollable. And but they also, the theory was also that women were biologically incapable of jealousy. And that we were only jealous about our children. You know, don't take my baby, don't steal my baby. But that women, being by nature frigid, had no capacity to experience jealousy. You see how, and women themselves, you know, were in a culture where they thought they shouldn't react at all if the husband took a fourth wife. So that level, when you interview men in prison serving a life sentence, most of them say, I don't know what got into me when I shot her. It's like it was a reflex. So the difference is that they acted on it. But it's at the reflex level, we all have that reaction. So we're all capable of a reaction of extreme shock, and the whole reptilian brain is activated. So here's the repertoire of the crocodile. Biochemically, heartbreak or bereavement is an assault on the reptilian brain. Nobody escapes that. You know, your husband dies on the operating table or says, you know, honey, this marriage is over, I'm leaving tomorrow, I'm already have a new apartment, and she's 20 and you're 50 and bye-bye. So you have you are under shock. The reptilian system is totally activated. So there are, usually neuroscientists say, there's the flee, freeze, fight, and the last one is not me inventing it, it's the neuroscientist who said the only word I have for that is fuck, because crocodiles don't make love. It's a mating without emotions. And so what's the word for that? So the scientists who wrote that had a little note at the bottom and said, sorry to use such vulgar language, but this is exactly what we mean by that word. So the first one is flee. You know, that's the crocodile on the beach feeling, you know, a jeep coming on the beach. They've immediately come out of their sleep and try to run away, flee. In psychology, reactions of denial, dissociation, idealizing fantasies, dissociation, these are flee reactions that are kind of part of the immediate reflex. Freeze, neuroscientists say they believe depression is a kind of freeze reaction. The psyche is frozen, doesn't move, no change, nothing moves. I see faces. It's a frozen psyche. Drugs, overeating, passive waiting, and what I call hooked on hope is all freeze reaction. Fight, that's when you take the gun and kill. Or murderous fantasies, following the person, and even, you know, if your partner died, there is an angry reaction. How dare you abandon me? How dare you die on me? So this fight reaction in the body is felt, even though rationally you don't feel that the other did that to insult you, but it's there. And fuck is the, you know, something you'll see in your patients, dangerous promiscuity, going in bar, taking risks. It's like a sense of, and many people who have, younger people who have heartbreak may have dangerous episodes of promiscuity, where it's not so much connecting with another human being, but it's that primitive mating kind of non-emotional connection with another body. And again, this should not be judged morally. It's there. It's dangerous, but you have to understand that the best way to approach that is to see, oh, here comes my crocodile. You know, if here comes my crocodile, if I could, I would shoot or bite or, you know, and so recognizing that level is very important. Now, it leads to an interesting distinction between the acute and the chronic.
The term allostatic low refers to the cumulative cost to the body when the extra effort is too much or carried for too long, like the excessive wear and tear on a machine. And acute stress may actually stimulate the immune system and is a necessary strategy for the body to run away from danger. But a chronic stress shuts it down, the best example of which is what psychologists call a burnout.
So this is very important because clinically, somebody who stays in the acute stress for too long, and that's the shock, you know, I cannot believe he or she left, what's going on? These reactions of activated heartbeat and sweating and disturbance of sleep may make you very, very sick. So how many of you experienced that aspect, you know, of the crocodile? Just raise your... So that's very destructive. And if it lasts for too long, damage accumulates. And allostatic load means it's interesting. It's like you, let's take the example of a shock. You know, you go to a film and you see your lover in the front seat with another woman. Boom, you thought he was being faithful. Boom, surprised. So in order for your brain to have blood and not faint, your heart has to beat much faster, otherwise you faint. So that's allo, which means different. The heartbeat is different. To keep stasis. You see, allo, static load. So how much of a supplementary effort is needed by the body just for you to stay awake and not die or not faint or not, you know, fall on the floor? That's what we mean by chronic. If it lasts too long, a reaction that is useful, you know, like you have a acute reaction whenever there's a car coming in front of you and you put the brakes on, that's necessary and that's acute. And you do have all these reactions. You know, you're nervous and mini shock. And you put the brakes on very, very quick. So that's why this reflex we need, and it cannot be extinguished without, you know, no human beings can control that aspect. A reflex is not something one can control. Any questions about this level? Maybe one thing that helps is to, you know, the Dalai Lama with the University of Pittsburgh did a lot of experimenting with his monks and neuroscientists. Maybe some of you read the book that came out from that. So what was interesting is they wanted to know if those trained monks could control their reflex. And so one way to do it, you can do it yourself, is to go very loud noise right in front of the eyes. So you have a reflex of blinking. It could be something worse, you know, like the example of a car coming fast at you, you will have a reptilian reflex. What's the difference between you and I and the monk? Is that they are quicker to come back to stasis. You know, they go into the blink, but it's much quicker. So they could see that. Whereas, you know, the person who is stuck in his or her crocodile psychology will get all flustered, maybe come out of the car and engage in a fight. It's as if they're still activated. But the monks is quicker to get back to normal. So now let's see the second character in the drama of heartbreak. So you always have your crocodile. And tomorrow we're going to look at the signs, physiological signs of the crocodile and how to really recognize it when it shows up. You have to be able to see, ah, here it comes. Crocodile. Hello, crocodile. Bah, bah, bah. It goes. The second character in the drama is the puppy or the baby. I say puppy because it's the part that we share with all mammals.
The mammalian or emotional brain, the hippocampus, amygdala, interior thalamic nuclei, septum, limbic cortex, and four including emotion,
This is surprising. It doesn't mean that we never grow up. It just means that there is always in us a puppy-like reaction that will freak out with a heartbreak. And it I use puppy instead of the child in me because I totally hate this approach to psychology, you know, the new age child in me kind of psychology that never seems to suggest that the goal of therapy is to grow up, is not to remain in the child and being victimized by its vulnerability. So there's a whole, you know, aspect of psychology that I'm very critical of because it keeps you in the child in me. And where does the patient learns to separate from that child and adopt it instead of making it the king of your consciousness, the center of your psyche. So that's why I don't use the child in you, but rather the little animal, the puppy. And because puppies will cry, it's an instinctual reaction. The little mammal has to express its distress often by sounds. No, ooh, ooh. Oh, I don't want to. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Yeah, see? So, wow, he says, what is this conference? My God, they're talking. Ooh, 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 ooh. Oh, he looks as if I needed help. Oh. So that's the way the little mammal will signal to the mother, I'm here, come and find me. So think about all these nights that you cry in your pillow. There's a part of that distress that is instinctual. You know, we have that dimension in us, and the fear of abandonment is extreme. Because a little abandoned mammal dies. There's no other outcome. Little abandoned babies die. This has been confirmed by many research. I'm sure you all know the research of the King of Bavaria in 1200 something, who wanted to know what was the natural language of humans if nobody talked to a child? And so he hired nannies to take care of orphans in a specific place with, you know, do not ever talk to those babies. We want to know what sounds they'll do when they start talking. He never got any result because they all died. You know, the little humans need that, and they need caresses, and they need sing-song, and they need tickling, and they need all sorts of things to really develop. And this was done, this experiment was done later on in Spitz, you know, I'm sure you all studied hospitalism, babies in orphanage at the last World War. And tragically, this experience was repeated in Ceausescu's. It's horrible when you see what happened to, if they were like animals, really, and never developed. So this is a level that we all have. So instead of giving it all the place in the psyche, you have to develop a kind of compassion for that little puppy, understand that is going to manifest itself and separate from it at the same time that you adopt it. Now you understand what's going on. There is a panic. You feel you're dying. You feel you're going to not survive this. And it needs to be taken care of by all sorts of means that we call usually limbic regulation. And I'll talk about that a bit more. But that little frightened puppy is there at every major loss. Loss of love, loss of identity, loss of, you know, it's as if in the psyche comes back, I'm going to die. So whenever you feel that and it's a bit irrational, just know that it's this level of the brain that's acting out. It's also Why, you know, when you have the archetype of the mother represented on Mother's Day or, you know, poems that we write for our mother, there's always a kind of sentimental quality to the mother archetype because she carries that nurturing, reassuring, consoling. And so images like this one makes us all, you know, this one. See, animals need that. They need it as much as we need it. So we all need that when we're sick, in pain, abandoned, lonely. And, you know, one can develop that with an animal. An animal can create a limbic regulation. It's been tested. MRI hat on a dog, and it's a coincidence. It was the scientist who was looking at limbic regulation, and his son, who was 12, decided to join his father in the lab, and they said, "Why don't we put on the dog and the boy?" And they had the same kind of waves, as if, you know, the dog and the boy had regulated their brain waves. And then they separated them and they were both in distress. And
the
then...
The heartbeat.
You know, and something we know also about women who share dormitories or roommates, they have their period at the same time. This is all limbic regulation. It also explains why little wolves separated from the pack have equivalent of nightmare. They don't have a good sound sleep. They're very, very nervous and they get sick. So we humans are mammals, and separated from the usual partner, there is that physical reaction of fear of dying. So animals do that. Well, you know, the old big dog adopts the little cat, and vice versa. The animals who are not afraid of each other will do that. Elephants are maybe the champion because they live so long. They have a huge limbic capacity of attachment. Elephants separated for 20 years remember each other, and when they find each other, they caress each other with their trunk. Elephants spend one third of their time caressing each other, touching each other. I think we should learn a thing or two from them. But, you know, it's this limbic aspect of the necessity, and people who live alone can find it even in just being in community. You know, we are in community. We're not alone. We're with a pack here. And it's the same feeling that you have when you go to a concert as opposed to listening at home. And when you're depressed and you go out to have a cafe latte at the cafe, it happens. But less and less we have places to go to connect and feel that connection. A study done at the University of Los Angeles has shown that in an office, when women learn something distressing, they get together in one of the, you know, they all get in the same office and talk about it. And guys usually tend not to, because of the cultural myth that you're not supposed to disclose your emotions. And they've also looked at what is the chemistry of those women getting together after a distressing news. Well, secretion of oxytocin, which is the hormones that are bonding, you know, of mother and child. They're beginning to use oxytocin to treat murderers who have very little compassion. And also, you know, studies that shows that hospices that allow cats and dogs are able to cut by half the medication for anxiety and depression. I'm sure you would agree with that, wouldn't you?
That's what we do.
That's what you do? And I heard you say that it was more powerful than morphine when you got the injury. So it helps. And you know, animals have a way of knowing where you hurt. And so this is all the limbic regulation. Let me get the other one. This one. And this one. And you see, it makes... Do you see what it does to us when we see these pictures? It makes us feel what it means to be nurtured. So this is what it means to have somebody. And losing that person, we're just like abandoned little wolves. So no wonder the person is in a deep, deep, deep panic. So attunement to the pop, the limbic regulation. Everything reassuring, consoling, and pleasurable. Pleasure is crucial in that phase. All kinds of pleasure. Pleasure is healing. Pleasure is important. Pleasure is necessary. Anything that activates, and we did talk about the wolf pack, but anything that activates the pleasure principle, laughter, a good massage, a prescription that anybody undergoing bereavement or heartbreak should do is get a massage, even every day if the person can afford it. Be with others. Even you don't need to say what's going on with you. You don't need to declare, to mention what your distress is, but just be close to people, be with friends, and also the capacity, you also have the capacity to develop the capacity to be by yourself, but to have a maximum of pleasure. And, you know, in the 19th century, it used to be that when you were sick or depressed, they would send you to Aix, les bains, and les villes d'eau. I don't even know how to translate. Like Vichy, Perrier, all these villages where people went to heal. And all that they did was drink water that was supposedly miraculous. But the reality is that these were very rich social community where you would dance, sleep in the afternoon, write your dreams in the morning, have affairs. A lot of them have had affairs. And then in the evening, one-star meal with very good meal. And it lasted 3 weeks, 3 months, until you had to be separated from your family. And you would go to these magnificent hotels, still exist, they're still there. The same is true of therapy at the time of Freud and Jung. You know, when you were in therapy with Professor Jung, you would go to Zurich, stay there, not work for 3 months, sometimes 1 year. You didn't go back and do your daily, you wrote your dreams. You saw the doctor 3 times a week discussing your dreams. And at the time of Jung, all of his patients had social relations. They went out together. Jung and you would say, you should go and, make friends with so-and-so. Here's her number. And when you read how today it wouldn't happen... But I can tell you that at Pacifica, where the studies are 5 years with the same group, a lot of that does happen, doesn't it? It's like the group becomes a support for whatever difficulty you're having, and being there 3 days every month is a pack, and the support is there. So, friendship releases oxytocin.
And placebo response and auto-hypnosis technique are also at that level, at the limbic level. It's a calming. It's a trusting. You know, like just like when you relax in the hands of the massage therapist, you trust that person and that person touches you. And this is a remembering, reactivating of nurturance. It has to feel safe. But patients who have been traumatized, sometimes they have difficulty. And it's always an indication that the nurturing was not there early on or was inconsistent or was mixed with some fear. Brain training, medication, and grief therapy, as opposed to reflexes, the limbic emotional part of our brain responds to training. Like, you know, a dog, an elephant, not so cats, but, you know, they can be, they do and don't, you know, depends. But our brain responds to training, so you can train the frightful puppy not to get into, you know, when you feel, oh, here comes my puppy, you know, I'm feeling I'm going to choke and die. You have to take action just like you would with the frightened puppy. Calm yourself, breathe, go out, call somebody, even if you don't feel like it, find something that will bring a measure of pleasure, and just know that it's your puppy reacting, and be patient with it. Don't try to judge it. Just know it shows up in a panic. Heart is filled with pain, the pain of abandonment, the fear, which are limbic emotions, sadness. So all of medications can only act at that level. The whole medical establishment, and even more so, all of the pharmaceutical industry wants you to believe that heartbreak can be healed at that level, or the crocodile level. So that's the whole foundation of the pharmaceutical industry. It can only act at what is biological, the chemistry of the brain. So all of our culture tends to see only these two levels. Those of you who may have read Michel Foucault, you know, was saying that psychiatry has become a kind of moral judgment of society. Why is it that you cannot work? How come you cannot get back to work? You've been crying too long. You got 2 weeks. Go back. I'm going to give you medication so you can do your work. But basically, there's a moral judgment, and he calls that psychic imprisonment. So it's as if, you know, there is... and right now, I brought an article that I'll leave on the table. There's a big... I must say it's really one of those interesting academic fight happening in the milieu of psychology, because the DSM-5 just came out. And it used to be that in the DSM-4, depression was judged as a clinical problem, but there was an exception for bereavement. So if you're depressed because you lost your partner or you lost your job or you lost your fortune to a crook or you lost something very important, then the clinician would make an exception. He would not label you as a clinically depressed patient. But in the DSM-5, they've taken that exception out. So that means that if you bereave, the psychiatrist can prescribe you the same medication. You know, they don't want to. So what the question, those who are against that say that what the psychiatrists are doing is to define what is normal, which is extremely dangerous. So normal means you're able to go back to work after 2 weeks. If you don't, we'll medicate you. So you see how it's a philosophical point of view. They say, wait, you can define, you know, the whole DSM 4 and 5, and in fact all of the DSM is divided in two. You have the problems that have a biological basis, Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, dementia. So that's half of the DSM. You can cure that. If there was a cure for Alzheimer's, everybody would want it. If there was a cure for schizophrenia, something in the brain doesn't work. The other part of the DSM is what they call personality disorder and mood disorder. And in this, the DSM in its introduction says there is a cultural aspect to that, and we cannot address it. For example, why is it that there is zero ADHD in kids raised in ashrams? Isn't there? Strange. So what creates ADHD? Hyperactivity in the school, too much sugar, too much fat, the fact that kids are never allowed to be alone, never, no silence, there are no silence at all. So we don't know yet what are the cultural factors. Many studies have to do with that. But fact is that ADHD appeared in the DSM-4 when Ritalin was ready. So first they developed Ritalin, then it appeared in the DSM-4. So those who are critiquing the move that was just done to treat bereavement as a clinical problem are saying, what are you doing? You're defining the normal personality, which was not supposed to be the aim of the DSM-4 or 5. Their task was to define what was not working, what was broken, the medical aspect. Yes.
When it was a V code, when the bereavement was a V code, they wouldn't pay for it, and a lot of the DSM is just codes for.
Absolutely.
So maybe now they want to get bereavement paid for.
Yes, and that's what they are saying, and it makes a lot of sense. And many parents say, we want ADHD to be in the DSM. It's the only way we will get special teachers' education. So you see, it's like it's a complex problem, because with putting bereavement into the category of depression, you could stay home and be paid by your insurance. So that's the good side of it. But the dark side of it is also there. So it's dangerous. That's what Michel Foucault was saying. It's dangerous for us to forget what this is doing.
To define normal
is very dangerous. That's why I mentioned, you know, a period in history where a normal woman was supposed to be frigid and not jealous. That was the normal then. DSM-3, homosexuality was a sickness. It's not anymore. So it's very, very dangerous. I'm not saying we should take one side or the other, but that discussion is going on in the culture. Now, let's get to the last character in this drama.
The third character in the drama, right brain and left brain, the wise human. Left brain, rationality, logic, literal meaning. Right brain, meaning, metaphor, symbol, freedom, moral judgment, artistic and symbolic expression. New thinking about lateralization, both sides have their perspective on everything. Individuation is reserved for the wise human, similar to McGilchrist's idea of balance
So again, the older James Ogilvy was saying, you know, the ancient Greeks had more of a right brain way of understanding the world. They would hallucinate. There was less, more traffic between the two sides of the brain. But what Mega Chris is saying is that our culture is definitely unbalanced, in that opposition between the two perspectives of the two sides of the brain is crucial for the balance of our culture. And the medical, rational, logic, mathematical, scientific aspect, which has given the most glorious discoveries of our time, has taken all the place, and there is an unbalance. There is a, and he finds it very dangerous, because the left side, the right side of the brain is where we understand metaphors, symbols, and meaning. And it seems he is suggesting that the epidemic of depression has to do with a cultural repression of the imagination, the capacity to symbolize and find the meaning. And that is, it is urgent. And not so much that we decide for one side or the other, but that we develop equally both sides, which I find interesting because, you know, the Greek period that I've studied more, the antiquity, there was a very balanced, and this is, you know, one of the, in the history of humanity, one of the most intensely creative period of history. So he is saying things in his own language, but if you read both Megill Chris and Jung, they have different way of saying it, but they are saying one has to live with the tension of the opposites and learn to live with that, not decide. Live with the tension, because it's both this and that. It's both. Now, one of the, again, interesting quotation that I found very strong is this one. This is Douglas Hofstadter, again, a neuroscientist who switched to becoming a philosopher. Maybe some of you read his previous book. It was about Escherbach. Escherbach. So he just wrote, I am, well, not just in 2007, I am a strange loop. And this is what he has to say.
An eye is a strange loop in a brain where symbolic and physical levels feed back to each other and flip causality upside down, with symbols seeming to have gained the paradoxical ability to push particles around rather than the universe.
That's pretty strong, isn't it? It needs to be meditated on. Now, I'm going to show you a list of, you know, when I work with people in heartbreak, and that's what we're going to do tomorrow, is finding the symbol where you are, the finding your symbol. You know, heartbreak is archetypal. That means everybody goes through a heartbreak. The first one being, you know, mom and dad have other things than precious little me to take care of. And there may be a new sister, or mom and dad get sick and die. And, you know, we all go through heartbreak. Otherwise, we remain children. So one disappointment after the other, of, you know, somebody not meeting your needs is, and by the way, I another kind of psychology that I detest is, you know, couples counseling where they supposedly learn to meet each other's need. What do you mean? Who is, where did that come from, that the partner is supposed to fulfill all your needs? That's a consequence of the child in me kind of psychology, you know. I want you to meet my needs. So you never grow, you know, it never works. Nobody will live, want to live a life trying to meet your needs. Grow up. It will not happen anymore. It will never happen. You're not a child anymore. So these disappointment that are part of every relationship are a way of discovering that, you know, you won't get all your needs met and better get used to that. So what I did is do a research with many people and practice with them, trying to find, and these stories, these cases I tell in the book, you know, one long case, William, who was in heartbreak for a year and a half. So the whole story of his and others' heartbreak.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.